After the murder of George Floyd last year, Dax Devlin Ross wrote a letter to his white male friends, the same people who were reaching out to him to see if he, a black man, was doing all right. At the time, protests against systemic racism and police brutality were erupting across the country, and Ross wanted his white friends to know how they could be better allies in the fight for racial justice. His letter ended up circulating far and wide, and now the idea has grown into a new book. It's called Letters to My White Male Friends. Dax Devlin Ross joins us now. Welcome. It's really good to speak with you.
Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you for having me on the show today.
Absolutely. So why don't you start with that letter that you wrote in the wake of George Floyd's murder to your white male friends of a certain age? What did you want them to know?
You know, I just felt inundated with concern for me, and I appreciated it from my friends. I really did. At the same time, I was a bit baffled. I mean, I think a lot of folks of color have talked about this over the past year. I mean, we have seen so many instances of people of color, black men specifically, being gunned down, murdered. And what I found myself wanting to do in that moment was connect my friends to their own emotional reaction to what was happening. Because I have this sense that the way we talk about race in America tends to focus explicitly on how racism impacts and influences the lives of people of color and black folks. But I really wanted my white friends to recognize that it impacts them too. And I tried to explore some of the ways in which they could begin to do some of the work that would maybe reveal to them the ways in which they've been racialized and potentially even harmed by the ways race and racism play out in their own lives.
I think this is important that you're addressing not just white people, but white men in particular, and men of your age, Generation X.
Yeah. Gen Xers were the first ones that were born into and raised within this sort of post-civil rights world. And what it meant was the ways in which we were educated often were through a benevolent lens that sought to, in many ways, obscure conversations around race, so that many of us became adults with very underdeveloped understandings of the ways in which race and racism operate.
Why? Was it because there was like this sense that we should be colorblind, that everything's fine, that it's not the way it used to be? I mean, why do you think that is?
A big part of it was aspirational. But then I think there was a colorblindness movement that does emerge and a multiculturalism movement that does emerge. And there's also this political swing that was happening in the 1970s. And I write about this as well. Like, unbeknownst to us as a generation, there was already a significant rollback happening that was playing out at the Supreme Court and playing out more explicitly in school busing and the suburbanization of a lot of, you know, the society we live in. So we have a lot of young friends of mine, my buddies. Their parents moved them to the suburbs. And many times our education, our lives became very resegregated, when in fact the intention was for us to be engaging with these conversations. We were not at all. I talk about in the book my own experience of being in an education environment and realizing how little race was discussed and how little racism was explored, such that I just felt often in class like I was alone and did not have in any way an experience that was reflective of my journey or my people's journey.
We need to talk about that time. You didn't just go to any school. You went to Sidwell Friends School in Washington, D.C. I mean, this is an elite private school. President's children have gone there. It's mostly white. Tell me more about what you realized about yourself through that experience.
With the time I was growing up and I was coming of age, I lived in D.C. in a part of the city called Shepherd Park, and a lot of the black middle-class families were sending their children to independent schools, and Sidwell was one of those schools. And so when I arrived there, I actually had the benefit of having some friends from my neighborhood who were older than me who were in the school. But in my own class, there were a handful of us. And I do want to make sure that people are aware. It wasn't as if it was bereft of color, but it was the case that we were sprinkled around so much. I found myself often in classes where I was the only one. And it was that sort of like experience of being in a very privileged environment. And there was a very rigorous academic set of, you know, expectations built around that. And yet we didn't nevertheless engage with, at least in my experience, engage in any kind of deep and what I consider responsible way with the ways in which racism and racialization was happening. And that, I think, is a function of many ways of like the 80s and the time period itself. And before, I think, larger conversations around how structural and systemic racism operate, that wasn't a part of our narrative, our experience. So that we missed a lot of that stuff.
But you say something in the book, something to the effect of you thought that because you'd gone to a school with the children of powerful white people, that you were in fact one of them, which you of course weren't.
I'm going through my own journey of learning, and I'm writing to you about my journey of learning for the purposes of you doing your own reflection. What happens when a young black person like myself, you end up in an environment where we don't talk about difference? In my mind, I start to believe that the world is going to treat me the same way I'm being treated by my white friends in this kind of very isolated environment. Yeah, you start to think like, this is all good. Like, we're all treated the same because in this bubble, that's how it's happening. But that's not how it plays out in the world. And in college, I begin to see a very different experience, in fact.
I want to ask you about something that comes up a lot in this book. You've hinted at it already. And that is that racism has, of course, harmed black people for generations and generations. But in fact, it has also harmed white men and white people. And it has robbed their lives of fullness. And that they likely don't even know it.
Right.
Tell me what you mean by that. Right. What is the harm?
I try to give people examples such as like we move through parts of our lives and they're just things that we begin to avoid because we assume that they're inferior. We assume that a book written by a black person is not going to be of the same quality that the book written by a white person is. We assume that art produced by black people may not be of the same quality. We begin to make a lot of assumptions because we don't have engagement with that sort of thing. And there's a significant loss that's a result of that. Even as we talk about how we have DEI and there's the whole DEI landscape and the work that's happening around it, I find a lot of
diversity, equity, and inclusion. Right.
Yeah, diversity, equity, and inclusion. A lot of people engage with that with a lot of trepidation, uncertainty, fear, and even defensiveness. And what I invite is that actually what we're trying to do is unlock the potential for us to live with more joy, more fullness. Because if I think about some of my interactions with white men when I might meet them the first time, there's often like there's trepidation, there's an uncertainty, there's a wariness about engagement. And I feel like what we could actually have is a real relationship with one another, but you've in many ways been socialized to believe that I am different. So the harm, I think, is broad in the sense that we miss out on a lot. We miss out on a lot of different people and experiences and engagements that we could otherwise have.
Was that something that was difficult for you to come to and understand that racism also hurts white people?
What I was always struck by was that in order to be a successful black person in America, you must engage with white America. There is no way around that. That is not the same if you're a white person in America. You can arrive at and ascend to leadership level, CEO, whatever you might want to call it, and really have never actually engaged with people of color or black people. And therefore, I see and encounter a lot of leaders right now who are looking and seeking the competency that they've never actually been challenged to have. And that is to be able to just navigate and negotiate difficult conversations at the heart of which might be race or identity or gender or ethnicity.
And so you're having these conversations with white men, especially more and more after the death of George Floyd. How does that leave you feeling? Like, are you energized, depleted, concerned, optimistic, all of the above?
I will say this. It's been really encouraging because there was a group of white men who decided to self-organize and begin to go on their own racial awakening journey, if you will. It was completely independent of me. And a couple of my friends, a couple of them were people I had never met but who had read the letter. And they actually began to meet every week and build a curriculum around that and then recruited other guys into this experience to see people take it on and decide that this is that important that I'm going to spend my Monday night 10 weeks in a row with guys I don't know talking about this. I'm incredibly inspired by that. I also really appreciate and honor when people come to me and want to have a real conversation that they feel like if they try to engage in more public spaces, they will end up being in many ways canceled. I want people to feel like it's okay to start the conversation with me. Please understand that I'm going to check you if I feel like you might be approaching something with sort of a lack of empathy or a lack of awareness. I'm going to try to fill that gap in, but I'm not going to turn away from you in the conversation. So yeah, does it require energy on my part? Sure, but I think that's the whole point of us trying to work through this together. So to your point, it's inspiring. It's a little bit exhausting, but it's necessary. We got to have white men in these conversations. We cannot have a racial reckoning without it.
Yeah. You use the word empathy there.
Yeah.
In relation to the conversations that you want white men to have with you. It's interesting, though, because I'm also hearing you say empathy is required of you as well. isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. This is a two-way street. I own the fact that I am both a man in this society. I'm a man who identifies as heterosexual, so I own and experience some privilege as well. And therefore, I need to demonstrate and model some of that empathy relative to these people who are in my life. Like, these white men, I'm the ones I wrote the letter to, these are some of my closest friends in the world. We're not talking about some people I just kind of know in passing. These are my brothers, too. And if I love you and I care about you, I'm upset and disappointed that maybe you only are now coming to this realization at 40-some years old. But you're here now, and I'm grateful for you being here now. We got some real work we need to do, and you need to be part of it because fundamentally you hold tremendous power and sway in this society.
Dax Devlin Ross is the author of the new book, Letters to My White Male Friends. Thank you so much for talking to us about it today. I appreciate it.
And thank you for having me on the show.